And without further ado, let's just go. I'm feeling podcasty.
Whatever that means.
Hello and welcome to the Hackaday Podcast. I'm Elliot Williams.
And I'm Dan Maloney.
This is episode 337, Homebrew Inductors, Teletypes in the Bedroom, and Action! Exclamation point. This week in the news, I guess it's last week's news, but Tom Nardi wrote up a piece for us, Dragon is the latest and final craft to reboost the ISS. There's a neat story about SpaceX's Dragon capsule has been cleared and did a practice run accelerating the International Space Station. What I didn't know and learned from reading this is it turns out that a whole bunch of vehicles that go up and visit the ISS have been giving it a nudge since essentially forever. In fact, they did it with pre-ISS space stations as well. So it's old tech. It's more complicated than you'd think. There's a lot of orbital dynamics. When they built it, the Russians were the ones flying ships up there. And so the docking port on the Russian side pushes it in the right direction. The docking port on the American side pushes it the wrong direction. So it's kind of a complicated ballet. They have to spin it around and push it from the other side. The diagrams of how they used to do it with the space shuttle are particularly neat. There's a bunch to learn from in this article. Yeah, the bittersweet news is that although the Dragon was pushing it up, this time, the writing's kind of on the wall for the ISS, and they're making deorbiting plans, and it may be the secret second reason for the Dragon practicing docking and pushing the ISS around is to get it ready to deorbit.
Woo. ISS has none of its own propulsion, or does it just have, like, thrusters for station keeping?
It also has its own thrusters. I read this in Tom's article. Sometimes they also bring up fuel and just refuel it to let it push itself around. But like you said, they mostly use those for station keeping and for kind of bigger, grosser movements. They like to shove it around with either the Russian Progress spacecraft. That's the like automatic version of the Soyuz.
Mm.
They did it with the European automatic transfer vehicle and most recently with the Orion. What's it called? It is the Orion.
Right? Yeah, Orion, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a little skeptical that this is the last reboost. I don't know. I feel like somebody's going to take the decision at some point here, like, well, maybe we can get another couple of years out of it until it's really all full of holes and it's starting to put people at risk. I mean, you know, it's space flight, so it's risk inherent, but it's like that, that intersection in town that everybody says should get a stoplight, but they're not going to put one up because it's expensive until something terrible happens. I feel like the destiny of the ISS now, until I don't want to say what it's going to do to people, but, you know, at some point it's going to become too dangerous to go up to. And then I think we'll see it. But I still think there's a ways to go before that happens.
Yeah, part of me hopes that we get a new space station up and running before we take this one down. But
true.
There's been no planning to do that yet, so I'm not hopeful. But
no.
Like, when the space station comes down, it's going to be super sad because we've had people, although, you know, not super many of them, up in space continuously since
2000. There has always been someone off Earth since 2000 or 2001. I think it's 2000. And in between the space shuttles in orbit or ISS or the Chinese space station or whatever, there's a neat graph someplace that I found that someone graphed out the number of people in space over time from 1960, whenever Yuri Gagarin first went up, to the present day. And you can zoom in on it. I'll try to find that and link it in.
That sounds really cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
And in other news, actually other space news, take it away, Dan.
It's always space news, it seems. Life on Mars, perhaps? They've gotten a lot closer. There was a big announcement yesterday. I'm still digesting it and reading the paper that was released, in Nature, to coincide with the announcement from NASA. But basically, they found some geology in Jezero Crater, in an area that used to be a river, and then the water level rose and it became a lake. So it has both river and lake properties. There's sedimentary rock there. There was some black specks in the rock. They say, what's that? They drill it. they look at it with the cameras there, the Pixel and the Sherlock sensors, and they come to the conclusion that it's a particular kind of geochemistry that is most easily explained by biological processes. They're still being super, super cagey about it. They're like, we've tried to find all the boring things that this could be, all the non-life things that this could be that we can think of. And they're coming up with nothing that explains it better than life. So that doesn't mean anything past what I just said. It just means that the simplest explanation right now is biological processes about, I think, like 3.5 million years ago or 350 million years ago. I forget which one. I've heard both figures. I actually heard some NASA administrator say 350 billion years ago, and I'm like, might want to check that math. But I think that was simply misspeaking. But yeah. Still, yeah, it's really exciting. They've got this sample locked away in a tube. Someday we'll maybe get it back to Earth and see if there's, you know, we can do more laboratory stuff and get a better conclusion. But all the sensors seem consistent with this is, you know, this is I believe it's an iron sulfide mineral. I can't remember the name of it, griegite or vivianite or something like that. I don't know. I'm gonna write up an article for links and try to explain this in a little more detail for anybody who's interested. So watch out for that.
You heard it here first. There has been little green man poo, fossilized little green man poo on Mars. Or are we talking, we're talking results of unicellular organisms? Or
important technical point, you heard that first from Elliot, not from me.
Ouch.
So direct your comments to editors@hackaday.com.
Ouch. Yeah, touche, touche. Well, on that high note, let's head on off to What's That Sound?
This is a journey into sound.
What's That Sound?
For those of you listening at home, What's That Sound? We play a sound, you tell us what it is. Next week we pick among the right answers and someone gets a Hackaday Podcast t-shirt. But first, our very own Dan Maloney gets a crack at it.
What is that? It's a theme song.
Yep.
This
one's for the 90s kids out there.
I'm going to say it's like the Magic School Bus or something like that.
Not bad. Not bad. Last one was High Culture. I did 2001 Space Odyssey. And this year I went a little lower, but it's pretty damn funny. So I hope those of you out there who know what it is are having fond memories.
That's it. I was not paying attention to a lot of things in the 90s. Yeah.
Well, very good. If you listeners have an idea what it is, head on over to hackaday.com/podcast. Scroll down to What's That Sound? You'll find the form to fill in your handle and your best guess, and we'll see who gets it right next week. Let's head on off to the hacks. My first one comes from Ibanez Sorenzo. Give your twist connections some strength. This is a really neat project, and it's a 3D printed project to connect two wires together without soldering. And I'll start off with a little bit of a hot take here. He says, and everyone in the comments says, oh my God, don't use this for mains because I don't know if it makes good enough electrical contact. I'm not saying you should. Hackaday's lawyers will absolutely tell you that I did not say that you should. But this is actually a really awesome way of connecting two wires together. The basic gimmick here is you take two wires, you strip them off, and you twist them together. The 3D printed parts are two. One is an inner part, which he calls a twist joint. And it's got, again, two kind of parts to it. One that grips onto the insulation, and another part in the middle that squishes, compresses the twisted part together even harder. You know, making hopefully already a decent physical connection even stronger. The second part of the 3D print screws into this thing and compresses it even further down. And he does a whole bunch of demos where he shows that it holds a load. In fact, he shows that it holds a load so well that when he's doing his pull tests on it, the wire itself actually breaks rather than the joint, which is pretty cool. I mean, I guess that just means he's got enough grip on the insulation that it's immobile in between, but what more do you need to keep your not bad electrical connection together? He also puts an ohm meter on it and does the pull test, and it doesn't get any worse. You know, the people worrying about this being a high resistance joint and thus the part that's going to heat up when you run significant current through it. I mean, first of all, that's not the intention of this project. This project is for putting funny little signal voltage electrical wires together. This is not a wire up your house with this type project. You know, personal stuff where you might want to take it apart and put it back together a bunch. For that, I really, really like it. But second, it doesn't seem to have all that much extra resistance. I mean, he's using thin wire and he's testing it with an ohm meter and he's not doing a 4-point measurement or anything. But, you know, he gets like 0.3 ohms or something, which is kind of what you'd expect from the probes on his ohm meter. So I don't think it's a particularly high resistance joint. The only thing I worry about is maybe the 3D print getting soft over time. Of course, if it gets super hot, it's going to melt and that's not going to help at all. I mean, there's a bunch of failure modes for this, but I think the idea is to have it be a temporary joint anyway. You know, just a quick temporary way to hook two pieces of stranded wire together, twist them, put the little thing on, screw it in, and boom, you're done. And he has them in a whole bunch of different sizes that you can scale up and down to different gauges of wire and how high resolution your printer has. And the whole video is just super well considered and screams, this person is a mechanical engineering student to me, because it's better done than I would have done it, and it's better done and then tested in all the right ways.
I don't think I would use it for anything past 14 gauge wire, which I have no idea what that is in square millimeters or whatever, but actually, I don't think I would even use it for 14, because 14 in the United States, that's what we use for like a 15 amp circuit. And I wouldn't want to have any temptation of using this in a residential wiring situation. That said, literally 100% of the houses in the United States are wired up with wires twisted together and covered with a little piece of plastic. And that's not a problem. It's not the source of worry for anybody. It's a source of worry when someone doesn't do it correctly. Someone does, you know, an amateur job and something gets loose and something gets hot and then you get a fire. That's a problem. But if it's done professionally with the correct equipment and the correct techniques, it's absolutely fine. This isn't that, though.
No.
And then, of course, there's the argument that, you know, kicks off in the comments about soldering versus not soldering. Does solder introduce a mechanical defect point, a lever point that...
Absolutely.
That the joint will fail at some point in the future? We've seen that argument before. I'm not sure which way to go on it. I think crimp connections are probably like a good solid crimp connection with a really good quality ratcheting crimp tool in the proper dies is going to give you, any joint done like that is going to give you all of the mechanical and electrical properties you need, I think. But then again, NASA solders some of their stuff. They've got a space probe that's a light day away and it's still, you know, it's still working with soldered connections on it. So
can't be that bad.
Just make your decision and stick with it, I guess, and use the best methods possible.
One of our writers who has worked in the industry has worked with both the Russians and U.S. space and says the Russians always and religiously crimp and NASA always and religiously solders. And they both have their firm beliefs about why one is better. And both of them have successful space programs. So shows what that's up to.
There you go.
And like you said, wire nuts, you know, to Europeans, they look janky, but they actually do kind of compress the wires together in a way that's, it's like lame crimping, but it's like crimping. And, you know, you do have tension on it because you're stretching the metal bit as you screw it down. So it's actually like holding it together with force. And that's something that's worth mentioning as well. And I think that you're not going to get that out of PLA. If you print this thing in PLA, it's going to push it together, but it doesn't have that same springiness that stretched metal does. So, you know, don't send your spaceships off with this. But this is such an awesome connector for kind of random hacker use that I just had to point it out. And I actually do think it's, I do think that it's cooler than its author gives it credit for. But of course, you don't want to overstate something like this, because then you'll have someone, you know, burning their house down and you'll get in trouble. So, and if you do want to solder it, he has a second version of the inner sleeve that has a cutout for the solder joint. Instead of pinching down on the part where you twisted the wire, it actually has a cutout. So if you solder the wire, you can put this nut thing around it, and it gives you the strain relief around the solder joint. So it takes the entire mechanical load off of the solder joint without relying on just physical contact of the wires together. So that may actually be, in my mind, if you have something where a simple soldered wire and heat shrink doesn't cut it, that may actually be the slightly beefier way to go, is solder it. And then one of those things that mechanical engineers are always worried about, they want the electrical connection to be different from the part that's taking the strain, right? You have you don't want the part that needs to conduct to also be the part that needs to hold it together. And so this gets you two of those, and it's a super quick and easy 3D print. It looks really cute. I like it in every possible way. It makes me want to play around with them.
On a similar homebrewing vein, tips for homebrewing inductors. This comes to us from Nick, and I consider inductors, I mean, I consider all electronics, let's get right down to it. You know, nobody understands how it works. It's all just magic. Of course, somebody's going to annihilate me in the comments for that. But really, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of us are just hand waving about, well, an inductor does this, and, you know, it opposes a current through the magnetic forces and all that. So I know what an inductor does. But knowing what it does and building your own are two completely separate things. Normally, we just say, okay, we need a low-value inductor here. You know, go to DigiKey or Mouser or whatever, order something, slap it onto the PC board. Or, you know, you're doing some sort of power electronics, something bigger, maybe, you know, transformers and all that stuff. But if you had to roll your own from scratch, where do you start? Well, you start with a guide like this. Now, this isn't super scratch built because Nick is depending on commercially available ferrite cores to build these inductors, which he says are for a big switch mode power supply. This is a big inductor. There's a lot of wire. There's four cores, so two pairs of E cores kind of stacked together. And he explains all about that, like stacking cores, what it means for, you know, in terms of inductance, what it means in terms of current carrying capacity, and all the little details. But it all sort of dials back to these commercially available cores that are well characterized and come with a data sheet, so you know which ferrite is being used, what the permittivity is of it, all the technical details, what the tolerances are, and all that stuff, which is good. But, you know, it doesn't tell you how to make an inductor from some random scraps of wire you've got lying around and fabric cobbling a core from something, which would be kind of the ultimate prison camp / desert island hack, where you want to build a radio and you need to know how to fabricate some inductors. So this isn't really going to help you in that situation, but nobody's in that situation. We're all just interested in building things, and he's building something that for which there is no commercially available inductor. So it's a bespoke sort of part that he's coming up with. And it's really nice that some good animations in the video where he explains how saturation works, what the difference is between a low frequency inductor and a high frequency inductor, why you would use electrical steel for the core, like laminated electrical steel for the core of a low frequency inductor, but that's not good for high frequency use, so you'd turn more to a ferrite. He doesn't get into the differences between the different types of ferrites and which ones are good for. You'd use these on an HF project, you would use these for a VHF project, you'd use these for, you know, gigahertz projects. Doesn't get into that kind of stuff because he's building a switch mode power supply. So I think he's probably shooting for the, I don't know, 400 kilohertz, 4 kilohertz, something like that range, I think is what he said. But still, it's a cute presentation, and it's got a lot of really good information about what you need to do to make your own inductors.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the ideal component isn't the component we've got in the real world. And like the difference between an inductor, it's just a bunch of loops of wire. Well, you can make it a better by putting something with magnetic permittivity in the middle. And then it's like, then it turns into black magic. And you were like, oh, he doesn't talk about which different ferrite blends to use for which frequency domains and stuff. And that's where, like, in radio projects is where ferrite winding gets above my head, turns into black magic to me. Yeah, I mean, it's not black magic. You just have to know you need a this one or a that one, and they all have funny numbers, and you can look up all the data sheets. It's not, like, impossible stuff, but... And when you talk to ham radio people, of course, they know which ferrite cores to use, but they've all gotten that from, you know, someone else who got that from someone else. And at some point, it's like dangerous half-truths. It's like the, you know, it's like sixth graders telling each other what it's like to drive a car. You know, it's all hearsay at some point. So I don't know which ferrite cores to pick. I always pick the one that is in my drawer and see what happens from there.
Keep a bunch around those little assortment kits of ferrite cores. The round ones, the toroids, keep one of those around and you probably will be able to cobble something together. Take a few turns off here versus there. Use the online inductor designers. Which was actually one of the nice things about this is the cores that he's using are from TDK. And I had no idea they were, you know, that much into TDK to me always was magnetic tape.
All right.
I guess now I'm finally seeing the relationship between TDK's magnetics and their you know, commercial magnetic tape business. It's the same material. It just happens to be smeared on a piece of polyester. But they have a calculator that you can use for figuring out, you know, really tuning in your designs on on your inductors based on their ferrites. And they have all kinds of different sizes and shapes. And you should be able to do what you need to do with a little help from these calculators and Nick.
Hard to beat that. Well, my next hack comes from GoTo10 Retro. It's a retro computing channel. This was Action with exclamation point, the best 8-bit language. And this is really cool because it's a whole computer programming language that I had never heard of and got to learn about by prepping up for this one. It was for the Atari series of computers, largely, although I was digging into it, it may have been written for kind of all of the 6502 processors and in principle portable to the Apple and some others of the day, but I don't think the company that made it ever did. The article accompanying this is all about the history of the language and a little bit about what it's like. It was kind of, you have to go back to the very early 80s in your mind when on mainframes you had the big compiled languages like C, and then on home computers like the Ataris you had BASICs, which are kind of interpreted languages. They're slow, and, you know, BASIC is kind of, if C lets you do a little bit of structured programming, BASIC lets you do essentially none. BASIC forces you to do spaghetti code. And in that context, this language Action, exclamation point, certainly looks very modern. It lets you, like, define functions with arguments, and it's a nice, kind of reasonably modern syntax. But what's most astounding about it is that they had an editor for the programming language that would run in the Atari, and you could switch back and forth between editor mode and monitor mode, where monitor mode was kind of like an interactive shell. So you could write the code and then compile it. It was actually a compiled language, and then run it. And the compiler was also super quick. So this kind of switching between editing the code, like with up and down arrow keys, and like really editing it, not like BASIC where you're like, you have to retype line 20. This is like, you know, an actual editor, and then you flip over into the shell, hit compile and run, and the thing's going. The compiler was fast enough that this compile run cycle didn't even particularly hurt you. It was advertised at the time as being the fastest 8-bit language for 8-bit computers, really neat looking and actually totally plausible. And so if you head on over to atariwiki.org, you can get a bunch of history on the funny early Atari programming languages, including Action. And what I learned from doing that is that not too, too long ago in the global scheme of things. In 2015, Clinton Parker, the guy who wrote Action, released the source code to the public under the GPL. So you, if you have a 6502-based computer slash if you want to port this to something else, well, A, you're crazy, but it does look like a really fun project. It actually looks like a half pleasant language to use. The Atari must have been a wild platform at the time. I was too young and didn't have one, but the Atari as an 8-bit computer had not just Action and a decent BASIC, but it also had a fourth language for it. And I know that a lot of people's early exposure to fourth comes from Atari fourth, which is just kind of bizarro. And if you compare that to the experience you got with any of the other early home microcomputers of the day, like I was a color computer kid, and that means I got BASIC and I got assembly language. You could peek and poke around in BASIC and there was an assembly language, and I actually had the assembler ROM cartridge for it, which was pretty cool. It had a disassembler built in. It was all right. But this Action looks like a very sophisticated programming language. And, you know, Atari had all sorts of bizarro languages written for it. So pretty cool. Learned something in this one.
Me too. Never heard of it at all. Yeah, this one was a complete mystery to me, and it's interesting that it's actually compiled, right? It's not interpreted, and the difference at the time probably would have been lost on me. I was just, you know, hunting and pecking at the keyboard and doing the Commodore things for the few programs that I managed to write back then. But, you know, the difference would have been lost on me performance-wise probably. But it's really cool that this actually exists. And I'd like to see what was inside the cartridge. This was for 6502 computers, right? Ataris were 6502s. Yeah. So, you know, what lives inside that cartridge? Is it just ROM? Is it there's some sort of processing power inside the cartridge? I would be kind of cool to take a look inside and see what made it tick. I don't think anybody wants to, you know, there's probably not too many of these left in the world. So I don't think you probably don't want to tear yours apart to see what's going on in there, but still we need to take a look.
Yeah, right. This thing came on a cartridge. So you had the Atari computer, you would plug this cartridge into it. Then you had the shell and the programming language and the editor and the compiler all set up. And it looks like it was ROM only. I don't think it had like any memory on it or anything. So there are ROM images out there. There are ROM images here too. So if you have an emulated Atari, if you have one up on MAME or something, I guess you could probably run those too for the original experience, the original Action exclamation point experience. I just love a programming language with an exclamation point in the name.
And you have to figure out how to pronounce it so that it sounds like there's an exclamation point in it. Action.
It makes writing our title really hard because the title says, you know, was Action the best 8-bit language? But it says was Action. And I couldn't parse the rest. It was just took me a minute.
Okay, turning back the clock a little bit, Retrotectacular, the noisy home computer from 1967. Talk about your early adopters. Rex Malik in this BBC, you know, newsreel sort of thing from 1967 demonstrates his home computer terminals. He has two of them, and they're basically the Type 33 teletypes. One of them sitting next to his bed, and a bit of a contrived bit, I think. You know, he wakes up first thing in the morning and checks stock prices on his leased terminal. The amount of money that he spent on this, someone did the math, it was £30 a week in 1967, which I guess works out to be about $480 a week now. So he was paying a pretty penny or a pretty pence for this privilege of these two terminals, which were connected to, as the BBC announcer intoned, an invisible brain 10 miles away. You know, back in the 60s, that's about the only analogy that anybody had to, you know, what a computer was. They called it a brain, so they kind of played through that here. Was it useful? Did it do anything particularly earth-shattering? No, not really. Like I said, he checked stock prices and made some trades, which I find a little dubious that he actually was able to make trades before there was any kind of trading platform. But hey, maybe, I don't know, maybe there was something going on. It doesn't say who he was working for, but I don't think it did anyways. But, you know, I assume he was
you know, he was one of us, the 1967 version of one of us. So he probably worked for some cool company that let him do this as a proof of concept or a demo or something like that. Apparently had one in the one terminal in the bedroom, one terminal in the living room, and he shows his kid, who was about 3 years old at the time, so right around my age. And I kind of wonder where that kid ended up, because he was poking at the keys and he was having a good old time learning how to operate this. So I wonder if that developed into anything and he literally turned into one of us. I don't know. Nick Malik, if you're out there, let us know. It's really cool that he had these machines in his house that totally impractical for 1967. Although Rex did make some predictions that within 20 years, people will have, what do you call it, a computer point to plug in a terminal in their house. Well, not far off. 1967 and 1987, and where were we in 1987? I mean, we're just kind of coming into the PC revolution, and people had modems, and they were talking to other computers and BBSs, and all that stuff was taking off around that time. So he was right. Not quite the same way. I don't think he could have anticipated that. Things would have been much, much quieter than his setup. But then again, you know, a daisy wheel printer in 1987 was still a pretty big racket. But still, it's really cool to see what they thought the computer, or what the future of computers was going to be back then, and the fact that they were able to do something like this as early as 1967 was another step along the way. And because they did these kind of things, we are where we are now. So I don't know whether to thank him or curse him, but
this is like pure retro tectacular, because you have to see this scene. It's a, you know, a sparse bedroom of a single bed, and the guy has a big teletype next to it, and he like wakes up and he's like, it's going chugga chugga, and he wakes up and he's like, oh, I must compute, and you know, he rolls over and he starts typing on this thing. And it's just so preposterous that this would be the future of computing. That said, I know some like hyper nerds who would love to have a teletype right next to their bed. So, you know, retro nostalgia is what it is. It's strong. But man, those things smell. Like, if you've ever smelled the oil coming off of a hot teletype, that is not something you want next to your bed. Although, again, personal choice, I'm not going to kink shame anyone here, but but then this so reminded me, and this is your point about this actually being a weird foretelling of our modern future. This guy's totally my wife. She rolls over and she's reading the news on her cell phone, you know, like she's a smombie just like this guy is, only he's a teletype zombie, rolls over in bed and has to trade stocks. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. It's lovely, lovely.
He plays it straight too. I got to give it to him. I feel like the BBC producer is probably, you know, coaching him and telling him what to say. I feel like that little bedroom vignette was probably a setup too.
It's like, so horrible.
You have a spare room, because we'll just put this here. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just. Like I said, if Nick Malik is still around, the little kid who is in the video, and what this was all about, please get back to us. Let us know. I would love to find out how everything turned out with your dad's awesome home computer system.
The other trope of the day, right, was the computer in the kitchen. Like, mm-hmm. when computers were unimaginable, these were the two least likely places you would have a computer, was like in the kitchen and next to your bed. And now look at the world we live in. We're like,
never more than 3 feet away from you is your computer.
People have to wash their hands or they get it all over the screen. Anywho.
Anyway, yeah.
Well, carrying on with the retro theme, man, I didn't realize we had one. The serial port, taking us a little bit into the future, at least from the 1967 perspective, a love letter to internet relay chat. And this is a really great history, although admittedly incomplete by the end of it. It's like a 20-minute long video, and it dives deep, and there are some interviews, and it's really neat. If you missed out on internet relay chat, or if you just want to know what IRC was all about, or look back in anger or love, depending on which way you feel about it all, It's a really great video. Short story long, there was a kind of an ad hoc network of American universities called BitNet in 1981, and people figured out how to chat amongst themselves and route it between the different computers. That initial routing was so bad that it actually started congesting their phone lines of the time, and they decided that instead of having each individual user write each individual user, they should have kind of centralized computers that then do the sub delivery of the messages, and these were the relays. Not super long later, a Finnish IT professional, Jarkko Okkarinen, developed what we know of as IRC now, except it was early IRC. Instead of the channels all being named, they were numbered. If you haven't used IRC, anyone can start up a channel. The servers are kind of loosely connected to each other because they want to be, and the whole thing is essentially pretty damn anarchic. IRC is a horrible, horrible mess, but it's absolutely lovely because of this kind of absolutely basic minimum viable system. And Maya actually points this out in her article, and this is why I really loved IRC, is that it's simple enough that you could write your own relay server probably with a week of study, and you can certainly write your own bots to, you know, stand in for you and do interesting and cool things over IRC in an afternoon. And that's what I always really loved about it, was that it was super accessible. One of the problems with IRC is when you go offline, the message doesn't get delivered to you. It's like a chat room, right? But if you want to like idle in a chat room, you had to, at least back in the day, write your own bot and leave it running on a computer somewhere to log all the chat in there. And of course, that means you can write scripts to like let you know when somebody mentions your name or an interesting topic to you. And it had this all like super readily available to the hacker kind of feel to it. I share the serial port's love for IRC. And also the kind of understanding that its ultra basic primitiveness is kind of what doomed it. But in being able to make up your own channels, it was completely anarchic and decentralized and very democratic. But then because only the hypercomputer nerds were using it, where's the democracy there? I would say, you know, a democracy of the computer nerds, which is a weird subset of democracy. But a lot of the things we get in our modern chat things come from IRC. And I would claim actually that Slack is basically just IRC warmed over. People mention Discord a lot in this context and other kind of channel-based chat rooms, because that is also part of the IRC legacy. We get hashtags from there. Channel names always started with hashtags. Slashes were started commands. And so, I don't know, is slash me still something you can type in Discord even? I think it is. All sorts of things we take for granted now come from IRC's history. So, and some of us were still active on IRC even into the 2020s. Mozilla threw in the towel. They used to have an IRC help channel and whatever bug contribution channel running on IRC, and then gave up on that in 2019. Which led one of our writers, Sven Gregory, to write a really nice quasi-obituary to IRC, Life After IRC, Your Move Mozilla. I'll link that in so you can go read it. If you haven't played around with IRC, it's quick enough to set up a server. There are still networks out there. I actually last logged into IRC probably about a year and a bit ago, and that was just for fun and nostalgia. But like in the early 2000s, it was the nerve center of the RepRap movement, for instance. There was like all the real development in RepRap was going on over IRC. It has a warm place in my heart. And because it was open, unlike Discord, everything was done, you know, done in the open, archived, and you can still go find old IRC chats people were having 20 years ago. There's some utility in that too, I think.
Yeah, I think I missed the whole IRC thing. I remember my first exposure to the internet really was Usenet, and just learning what forums were like and learning what trolls were like. But that was my first experience with, like, you know, real-time exposure to what was going on in the world that didn't rely on, you know, coming through, you know, some sort of commercial media or news media or anything like that. And I was fascinated by that. It was just like, wow, you could actually, you know, find out what people are thinking in real time, which was cool for about
20 minutes until the, you know, the people really started telling you what they were thinking. And, you know,
exactly.
It's been downhill since. And I really like that quote in the video that internet used to be a place to escape to, not escape from. It's a little sad that we're here, but that's the way it goes.
IRC was kind of a tool for a more civilized age. It was, you know, just absolute anarchy and pure chaos. But this only works when you have a small community. And I think in comparison to the big wide internet now where everybody is online, it was a tiny, tiny little group of nerds on IRC back in the day. And so, yeah, I think some of the nostalgia for that is based around that fact. And I don't think that has anything to do with IRC or anarchism or any of that, but actually just around the fact that it was a different crowd back then. It was a different party. But that said, IRC was hella cool. And if you missed it, check out this video. It'll let you know about some of it. And it kind of captures my experience of it as well.
Well, last up for me in getting away from the retro stuff is making an ultralight helicopter. And this is by Ultralight Helicopter. It's a video that shows the four-year-long build process of scratch building this ultralight helicopter. Now, I have the utmost respect for homebrewers in the aircraft space. That is some cool stuff. Being able to build a working airplane in your garage from a kit. Ultimate respect. More respect for someone who's doing it without a kit. But all that said, absolutely no way in hell I'm getting anywhere near
Thank you.
This thing.
Thank you.
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Any helicopter, a professionally built, you know, a certified helicopter is still barely holding itself together long enough to get in the air. I mean, I understand the all about controls, the swash plate, the collective and the cyclical. I get all of that. I wanted to learn how to fly helicopters for the longest time. I still do in some way. But the idea that you're sitting underneath this thing and that rotor blade is spinning, what, you know, half a meter over your head, that helmet's not going to do much, I'm afraid. if something decides to come apart, it's all over in a second. And that's one of the things that people in the comments section were noting, that the rotor system is very, very small and has no angular momentum to get you through the transition of like a loss of power event so you could actually auto-rotate. And that's what the big helicopters, a three-blade, four-blade, five-blade rotor system provides way, way more momentum so that you have at least a couple of seconds to recognize a loss of power event and then get the control set up to auto-rotate and get yourself down to the ground safely. No margin of error here. That said, it's cool. I'm not going to complain about that. And it welds, the weld quality was cool. It was a lot of aluminum, a little bit of stainless steel, but mostly aluminum. So whoever's building this had to step up skills because aluminum welding is not easy. You've got to know what you're doing to make good looking joints, and good looking joints are probably strong joints, and you certainly want strong joints. Absolute kudos for taking this project on. Love to see it. Just don't want to be anywhere near it.
I hear you. Helicopters are a weird beast because, you know, they're doing a lot of things to make a system that really shouldn't work. Like, you know, you've got the one blade, and so the body you're sitting in wants to spin around. And so then they're like, okay, well, we'll put another fan way out at the back on this tail that'll rotate against, you know, the intrinsic spinniness of the thing. And no. And then you have to change the angles and the, you know, like you said, the whole swash plate mess is a lot of mechanical complications in my mind, especially if you compare it to something stupid like an airplane, where it's really just like a wing. And then you put some flaps on it to make it fall over one way or the other. And, you know, you make the thing balance right and it basically flies okay if you put enough engine in it. This is complicated.
Unfortunately, for anybody who's, you know, who wants to watch the video, you're not going to see it fly. I didn't see you know, a test flight anywhere in there. I suppose maybe that's a separate video. But if it did, I feel like it would be similar to the old films of Igor Sikorsky when he was flying in his early helicopters and, you know, just wearing a fedora.
Yeah,
that was his safety fedora.
Crash fedora.
And I did. I used to watch those even a long time ago. I'd watch those, and I'm like, wow, that took a lot of guts. actually sit underneath something that you built, and you should know that whether you were careful or not building it, but did you have a moment where you didn't, you know, tighten something down or properly weld something or use the wrong material because you didn't know any better, or take all the things that, you know, this build has going for it, take all those away because all of that's based on 100 years of rotor wing flight that we have experienced. But, and then you take all of that away, plop your fedora on, sit in this thing, say, spin it up and say, hey, let's find out. Having no idea how to fly a helicopter because nobody's flown a helicopter before because it never existed before.
Right.
That was, go back to Igor Sikorsky. And that, to me, that's just like the ultimate in aviation pioneering, and the Wright brothers too, you know, in a lot of ways. What's this thing going to do when it gets up in the air? Well, 9 chances out of 10, it's going to kill me, but it didn't. And here we are.
All right. Well, I have way too many quick hacks this week, and I want to start off with kind of an apology. The first old phone upcycled into Pico projector plus ASMR. It's a neat video by Hui Vector, but I think it's a fake project, or maybe it's a real project with fake results. It's a neat Pico projector build, but I think I agree with all the commenters here that the results as displayed in the video look like they could not be produced by that lens and projector setup. So I think that's a bummer. And actually, I totally agree with Alan Wilson here, who says, you know, this was probably a project that started out and just didn't get stellar results. And so he just overlaid the video projection with a fake one in post to make it look better for YouTube. But that's really a shame, because you can actually do something, you know, kind of half useful and interesting and cool with the simplest of optics and with a setup like this. And you can learn a lot by taking apart an LCD. And like, everything that he does in this video is worth doing. And that's kind of overshadowed by him faking the results to look probably 3 times as good as they actually did. So boo to fake results, but yay to awesome experimentation with amateur optics. Next up, Eelco reverse engineering a robot mower's fence. Boy, here's my second apology of the quick hacks. This is about how to make an electric fence to keep your robot lawnmower within your property. Basically, they put out a 3 kilohertz, it is reverse engineered, signal that lets the robot know when it's nearing the edge and it's time to turn back. This project is probably overcomplicated. He actually reproduces the full waveform by sampling it and running it back off the DAC on an ESP32, when I think probably any old 3 kilohertz signal will do. Nonetheless, the apology here is that why would you buy a used lawnmower without its fence thing? Probably because it was stolen. Don't buy stolen lawnmowers. Mary Lou Schwartz, the 555 as you've never seen it before in textile. When a textile shows up on Ken Sheriff's website, you know it's a Navajo style weaving of a 555 die, right? Mary Lou has done a bunch of kind of die shots in weavings, and they're just absolutely fantastic. You should check them out. Did not expect to see that today. A look at not an Android emulator. This is about the Android translation layer, which is kind of like Wine for Android. It lets you run Android apps on your Linux computer without firing up an Android virtual machine like Waydroid does. Looks very cool if you haven't used it and want to run Android apps on your computer. And last up, Peter Shirley, No Plans for the Weekend, Learn Ray Tracing, is an ebook that explains ray tracing. It's called Learning Ray Tracing in 1 Weekend. And if you get into it, the second ebook he's got available is called Ray Tracing the Next Week. And this is followed up by his masterpiece, Ray Tracing the Rest of Your Life. I kid you not. It's 3 different ebooks, Gentle Introduction to Ray Tracing and Beyond. I think that's really fantastic. Ray tracing's hella cool. makes pretty graphics by simulating physics.
Maybe the robot mower just wandered away.
Yeah, they just wander away when nobody's looking and their fence isn't working anymore. And then they show up on eBay somehow. There's a case to be made that, you know, somebody doesn't want to dig the whole cable system up and they just sell the mower without, you know, uprooting their yard. Or if they're broken, it's not worth it to you to do that. I could see reasons to do this. I also see reasons just to reverse engineer stuff because it's fun to see how it all works.
Okay, I don't have that many articles in my quick picks, but my first one is Restoring a Cheap Fume Hood by Projects in Flight. We've been following Projects in Flight's projects for a while now. He's on the homemade semiconductor kick. That requires a lot of nasty stuff to be slung around, dopants and etchants and things like that. Fumes are a problem. Somehow, he managed to pick up for a mere $200 a very, very nice looking fume hood, much cleaner than any of the fume hoods I ever saw in the labs I worked in. And get that working at home. Not a trivial task. You do need to provide quite a bit of air out of these things, hence their, you know, how they work, but it can keep you a lot safer than doing things on the desktop or benchtop. And yeah, you don't want to mess around with some of the things that Project in Flight is messing with. Next up, Smartphone Sensors Unlocked, Turn Your Phone into a Physics Lab. This is about FiFox, which is an open source platform for running on your smartphone that provides access to all of the sensors and the bewildering array of sensors they certainly are. We've got tricorders in our pockets. Let's just face it. You've got, you know, GPS and accelerometers and gyroscopes and magnetometers and all kinds of sensors built into these things. It's a shame to just let them sit there and monitor your every move and report back to the hive mind. You should be using them for your own evil purposes, like in measuring acceleration and trying to figure out what's going on in the world right around you from a physics point of view. So FiFox will let you do that. And finally, on a related note, heart rate monitoring via Wi-Fi. This isn't a dongle that plugs into anything that uses Wi-Fi to report your heart rate back to the previously mentioned hive. Rather, this is using the Wi-Fi signal soup that we all swim in every day as the detection method for measuring the heart rate of an individual. It comes from the UC Santa Cruz, a team at UC Santa Cruz, Go Banana Slugs. It's sort of a proof of concept project in a research to see if it's possible to do this. And I'd like to see more about it.
All right, that brings us to our Can't Miss articles. These are long-form pieces written by our fantastic Hackaday writing staff. And if you thought I couldn't contain myself on Quick Hacks, wait till you see what I've picked here. There was kind of a threefer going on among the Hackaday writers. I think it's, you know, it's late summer and everybody's been doing their summer projects and wanted to write about them. And so we had three pieces come out this week. One from Arya, who's been teaching herself FreeCAD, and so wrote a two-part series, actually, FreeCAD 4A, where she talks about making a case that goes along with a PCB that's got a little USB-C connector on it and a bunch of neat design tips around how to do that and how to build cases for your PCBs, in particular, with FreeCAD. Maya Posh came up with Bootstrapping Android Development, a Survival Guide, and this is her using Qt libraries to make Android apps and showing how to set up all of that tooling. And I think that's something we were complaining about on the show a couple weeks ago, and Maya's like, oh yeah, well, I know how to write Android apps. And so she wrote up her particular take on how to do that. And last up, Al Williams, the Android Linux Commander, is the second in his series on doing phone apps the exact opposite way, using App Inventor and Bluetooth, and how to make that work with your microcontroller projects. And in this case, he's got a MacroPad, and he wants to have it configurable with a menu on his cell phone. And so he's writing the App Inventor program that lets him configure this device and set it up. And it's really cool too. And I think what's really neat about these is that these are all actually personal projects of our Hackaday writers. And so if you want to see what people are into and what ways they do things, these are actually really fun pieces to check out. But what's also interesting about it is that, you know, I've done some app programming on Android. I've done a lot of FreeCAD. I've even tried out, you know, some of the stuff Al's doing with the keyboards. I mean, I have my own keyboard. I use my own homemade keyboard here. I intersect with all of these projects a little bit, and I would have done things differently in all of them. And I think that's really awesome, because what these show is that there are kind of a bunch of different ways to approach projects. And like the normal way to do FreeCAD is with the part design workbench instead of the part workbench. And that uses kind of a constructive solid geometry approach, whereas the other one uses a more modern sketch-based approach. Fine. These are all different ways you can skin the cat. And I think it's awesome that Arya is showing this particular approach, because frankly, there are enough tutorials on the web showing the sketch-based approach. Ditto Maya, who's using Qt to do her Android development. That's a kind of, I don't know, quirky choice for the windowing and graphics stuff. But, you know, more power to her. She shows you how to do it. And ditto Al's. So I guess what I'm saying here is that as readers out there, I want you to know that these folks are also hackers like you. And I don't want you to think that just because we write up something in Hackaday, it's the right way to do it or the wrong way to do it, or even that we think it's the right way or the wrong way to do it. I'm not sure there is a right way. These are just cool and interesting ways. And I thought that was really cool about all three of these articles, because they kind of shined a light from a different angle on a bunch of projects I've seen before too. If any of them strike your fancy, go read up. They're great projects. You know, watch over some of our folks' shoulders as they're doing it. But like somehow when you write something and publish it on Hackaday, you're automatically some kind of authority. But I really do want you to just look at these as being, here are a bunch of hackers like me sharing the way they do these things. And I think that's lovely. And that's, you know, what the hell? That is the Hackaday spirit.
Yeah, I've written up a couple of my own projects and you put them out there. And I'm not saying this is the way to do it. I'm just saying this is the way I did it. I'm more than willing to get feedback if there was a better way to do it, or if there was a just even a different way, not necessarily better, but just different. I'd prefer if that feedback were kind, which is not always the case. And just seeing, you're right, the look over the shoulder and seeing how someone else did something, and you find ways that work for your brain that maybe this person is doing, or what they're doing makes absolutely no sense to you, but it gives you kind of that hook into understanding it in a way that your brain will be compatible with, and really just sort of a guiding light, a hand to understand what the next step is often all you need. And I like these articles for that reason. My pick this week is another Arya piece, GPS and its little modules. I mentioned before about how electronics is all magic, being a little bit hyperbolic there, but if you really want true magic, GPS is real, real magic to me. There's all kinds of stuff in there that should combine together to make this thing not work. Ultra poor signal to noise ratio. When you finally get the signals, you've got, you know, to take into account general relativity and special relativity in order to make the time signals work. There's a ton of math. There's all kinds of things that seem to be conspired against you. And yet somehow we can condense this all down into a little square chip that fits on a PC board. It looks like a piece of ceramic and it does everything for you. And that's magic right there. The article isn't talking about how GPS works and using GPS as the Kleenex of global navigation systems. We're just going to call it GPS, even if you're using GLONASS or Beidou or any of the other systems. That's not this article. This is about putting that little box into your project and getting information out of it, GPS information out of it. Turns out that is surprisingly simple, surprisingly reduced to practice at this point, where GPS modules basically just spit out a continuous stream of serial data that you can very easily intercept with your microcontroller of choice or other computer. Pull that information out and do the necessary parsing. And even then, you don't have to really do anything. There are modules that are already pre-written that will take that stream of information and give you what you want, which presumably for GPS is latitude, longitude, altitude, but also time-based signals. Nice shout out from Aria to the recently concluded One Hertz contest. Several of our entries were based on GPS, one pulse per second output from modules like this. There's a good discussion also about battery backups. You'll notice that some modules, some GPS modules already come with a little holder for a coin cell, and that's important for keeping the module, even when it's off, keeping it in sync with the satellites or giving it at least a knowledge of where the last satellites were that it saw so that it can get a fix much faster than doing it right from a cold fix. Good article, a lot of hands-on nuts and bolts kind of stuff and how to put these modules into your projects, and can refer to this or at least use this as a jumping off point for getting GPS into your projects.
Yeah, that's what I liked about this one, actually, is that it didn't get into any of the magic that makes GPS work, which, you know, it's awesome and it's a fantastic topic by itself. But if you are honestly just past the I'm blinking an LED on an Arduino phase, you can interface with the GPS. And maybe that's your next project. Like, maybe that should be the next thing you do, because it's that dead easy. It's, you know, get your microcontroller, which has a serial peripheral, to speak serial to this thing, and then just read the numbers that it's giving out to you. It's absolutely lovely and absolutely simple to use. And GPSs are real fun for that. Back in the day, like Dan said, it was, you had to buy a GPS receiver and it was a complicated and expensive thing. And now, like, $10 gets you a GPS receiver that receives all three of the global navigation systems and doesn't care which ones it's listening to either. Like, see, I did it too. I got stuck in the weeds of how GPS works for half a second there, when the whole point of Arya's article is, hey, interfacing with GPS units is so damn cheap and so damn easy that you should add them to your projects. Here's a couple things you need to know, like slow to boot up at first, make sure they have a battery backup, et cetera, et cetera. But other than that, not much to know. When I was living in Washington, D.C., I was doing a lot of skateboarding, and I actually started a project to skateboard every street in Washington, D.C., which isn't impossible. It's a kind of a compact city. And I thought I was going to do that. And so I built a logging GPS unit for myself. And the thing had like a pretty big EEPROM on it and a GPS and a battery and a couple LEDs to blink status. And that was the whole damn thing. It just wrote my location to it. And when I got home, it downloaded it to my computer. And that was the whole gimmick. You know, I didn't even come close to skateboarding every street. That whole project went nowhere. But the GPS logger was awesome. And that is the spirit in which I want you to, if you haven't, go out and buy a GPS module and put it in your project. Well, that wraps it up for this week's Hackaday podcast. Thanks very much for listening. To follow any of the links, head on over to hackaday.com/podcast. And if you see anything cool or do anything cool, write us tips@hackaday.com. And until next week,
keep on hacking.
That's what it sounds like when my eardrums are getting blown out. Oh, have I uploaded it? No. Hold on. Give me a
second. The fever dream of an 90s TV.
It was a little bit weird. All right. Well, it's time to get serious. Kind of squishes.
This comes to us from,
you know, with magnetic permanence. Magnetic
permittivity.
Jarkko Oikarinen. Oh, man. Finnish names. Oikarinen. Oikarinen. Right. Huh. Yeah, teletype in the bedroom.